Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're all very welcome back. Juliana Adelman, novelist, is in studio with us. Good morning to you, Juliana.
Good morning, Oliver.
You've sat in during the break and I didn't want to speak to you because I want to gush. The Grateful Water was your novel. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
Even though it's kind of it's grim Victorian 19th century Dublin, which you clearly love.
Yes, I think I spend a lot of my mental time in grim 19th century Victorian Dublin.
Curious. Yeah. Okay. We'll find all about you while you're there. Juliana Adelman, just to let you know, she's originally from America, but she's lived here longer than the other side of the Atlantic, this side of it. Fan of Dublin 19th century, and that is where The Grateful Water is set, and so on. I suppose the novel in 19th century Dublin was kind of inevitable given what you do as a day job.
Yes, I'm a lecturer in history in Dublin City University, and yeah, my research area is
the best university.
Century.
Yes, yeah. I've been there.
Are you?
Yeah,
are you?
Okay. You.
Very good.
So you're in the School of History and Geography?
That's correct. Yeah.
So what do students? What are your students learning from you?
Well, actually, I teach much more broadly. I don't actually teach any Irish history, really. The history of 20th century public health, but mostly, really? I teach environmental history, kind of global environmental history. I teach the MA students historiography, and I teach history of medicine. So I do filthy, dirty, sick bits for the history of medicine.
Yeah. 19th century medicine.
Yeah, yes, some of it is 19th century. Yeah, yeah.
The horror aficionados,
exactly,
have done very well out of that.
Yeah,
whole genre, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there? Oh my God, no! I won't even go there. Is there a particularly horrific era? I said, "Whoa, well, hang on a second. It's not even 9:30." And your first book was about animals. Was that right in 1990?
Yeah. So that was actually my most recent nonfiction was called Civilized by Beasts, and it was about Dublin in the 19th century through human-animal relationships, because I guess what we forget in the modern city is that in the 19th century there were almost as many animals, as non-human animals, as people, because they needed them for food and for work, and so the city was absolutely full of them.
Yeah,
so,
you forget that, and suddenly the smells begin to conjure.
Yes, absolutely, yeah, full of them and their wastes, yeah.
the general chaos.
Yeah.
We can hear from your accent that you're an American, but you've got the lovely neutralised...
Yeah, I've been here a long time. I think it's 23 years. My accent may be suspended mid-Atlantic at this stage. And I have an American friend visiting at the minute, so I might be more American than usual even.
Oh, interesting. Where did you grow up in America?
Outside of Boston, I lived in Richmond, Virginia for a little while.
The capital of the Confederacy,
yeah,
as it
absolutely,
was.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Childhood in Richmond, Virginia. And then my family live outside of Boston now. Yeah.
So would you have had a Southern accent also competing with a bit of Boston at one stage?
I don't know. I mean, I don't remember. I suppose I moved to Concord, Massachusetts, where my parents live now, when I was 13, and I'd say I shed any Southern accent.
Nomadic kind of life,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think Americans move around a bit more than Irish people on average. Yeah, so my father moved
often
for work.
Within
yeah.
that continent nation that they live in.
Yeah.
You know, the Irish people like to say, the Americans, 90% of them don't have passports.
Well, that's true. I mean, that is true. They're not great foreign visitors.
But I mean, they have an entire continent.
They do.
Explore,
they have a lot of space to move around.
We kind of need it on the, given the size of our land mass. So growing up in America, you were there until you do college and everything there?
So I did. Undergraduate in America, and then I ended up coming over here for a master's because of a detour in Vietnam. So I studied biology as an undergraduate, and I was interested in typhoid fever, and I went to Vietnam to do a project. It didn't work out. I ended up traveling, and I met my now husband, who was also traveling in Vietnam.
You met a big Irish head appeared in Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah. Several Irish heads. There are quite a lot of Irish heads,
everywhere.
Actually. Yeah,
in Vietnam. So, I fell in love, and that's the story.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
But had you come to Ireland? You had done the
interim.
I'd never
been.
Oh, you've never been. Okay.
I'd never been. No. Yeah. So my first visit was to visit him after we both returned to our respective homelands from Vietnam. Yeah.
So did you have a romance with an Irishman in Vietnam over a time? I presume these are fleeting travel
periods. Yeah, it was a couple of weeks. Yeah, yeah.
Go away.
Yeah.
A holiday romance.
Sticking power. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so then you more or less make your life in Ireland.
Yeah. So I came over. We kind of went back and forth for a bit. I was in Boston and I had this idea. I didn't want to do science anymore. I decided I would do science journalism. So I applied. I'm also an alumna of DCU. Went and did the master's in science communication. And we sort of thought, well, if the romance doesn't work out, at least I've got a degree out of the bargain. So, and then I didn't move back. Yeah, so that was 2002.
It sounded like then maybe, I gather there might have been a bit of a panic deciding to do science in the first place. Was there because of your parents?
Scientists? I think, so my father is a doctor and my mother has studied science and was a nurse at one stage. And I think most of us are confused in our 20s, right? I think that's pretty normal. I had no idea what I wanted to do. The American university system, a little more flexible, so you don't have to have a major when you start. You can kind of mess around for 2 years trying to decide what it is you're going to study. So I took all kinds of things. And then I think at some stage during my second year, I had a panic of like, how am I ever going to get a job? So maybe I should do something that seems like it would have a job at the end of it. So I did biology, even though I was clear I didn't want to do medicine.
Guilt or something going on.
Maybe a bit of guilt. Yeah. Because, I mean, university is expensive in America. It's only gotten, expensive now. So I think, you know, when you start, you just think, well, this is a great time. I can do whatever I want. And then maybe about halfway through, you start to think, yeah, maybe I should do something productive at the end of this to make up for, you know, the money that has been invested in my education. So, yeah.
And of course, as an American coming here, you don't have the free third level, as we call it, in inverted commas.
That's
in
right.
Ireland. There is something called a registration fee, which is now started to match what the original fees were. But it is expensive to come here as well, is it, to do
a master's? I mean, it was still cheaper than, you have to remember, I suppose, living in Dublin, even at that time, the rent was okay.
Yeah, it was
So it was quite a different landscape to what we have
Hugely
now.
Hugely expensive now, if you can find a place to rent.
Yeah.
So that's the checkered story of your life and how you come to Ireland and a successful mission to Ireland.
Yeah.
So we know the science bit. So how do you become a historian then after?
Well, you decide you want to stay here. You're not sure if you're ready to get married. And then you see an advertisement for a funded PhD program in the University of Galway. So it was the NUI at the time. So I applied for this PhD in history and it was in the history of science. So it seemed like vaguely related, right? I had done a project on the Natural History Museum when I was doing my master's. So I was interested in history. I had taken one history course in university as an undergraduate. It was on early modern Russia. So I was really prepared for 19th century Irish history. And I was the only person who applied for that PhD scholarship. So I got it. So as my husband joked, the state paid me to stay. So I had this PhD scholarship and I loved it. I mean, I really enjoyed the research. So then I guess I was a historian after that. So
you were a historian. And the state paid you to stay, but also sometimes we educate people and they leave.
That's true.
And then were you thinking a life in academia, that's where I'm going to work?
Yeah, I think everyone starting a PhD thinks that that's probably what they're going to do. And then, as I suppose anyone who's doing one who might be listening knows, it's very difficult then to get a job. So I was very lucky.
Yeah.
I had two postdocs, another period of research study basically after the PhD in both of them in Trinity. And then, and then I applied for a job in what was St. Patrick's College at the time for the BA
teaching
program.
Teaching college in Drumcondra.
Exactly, yeah. So, which is now part of DCU. And and I got, much to my surprise, I got the job and I've been there ever since.
Very good.
Yeah.
So we have scientist turned historian and now turned novelist the next stage in your career.
Obviously, I'm very scatterbrained. No, I think I'm just interested in a lot of things. Mm. And so I like to try different things.
But you're merging your interests.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I think that's fair. Yeah.
So give us an overview of The Grateful Water.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a mystery set in the 1860s in Dublin. And it sort of follows two women who know each other from a household. One of them, who is the niece of the grand dame of the household, and then one of the servants. And it follows them not just through sort of through their relationships and their sort of efforts to wrest control of their lives. And I suppose the other storyline is the investigation of a baby's body that was found by the husband of the servant, who was a butcher.
Yeah. You open up in the most miserable way.
Yeah, with the river.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that was unfortunately infant mortality, child mortality was a huge issue in this era, wasn't it? Almost just every day, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think the infant mortality was a big problem, not just to do with disease and, you know, malnourishment and in some cases neglect and... Yeah.
But not to put people off, because the novel is about all these interesting characters.
Yeah.
Living with the mad aunt in Mountjoy Square and the detective, the police detective.
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing him, I have to say. So the detective and the butcher are both named after butchers that I encountered in my research.
You're saying real butchers?
Yeah, real butchers. Oh, okay. Yeah, because they would petition the corporation for permission to do various things that they were not supposed to be doing.
Detective Pekin.
Yeah, so Detective Pekin,
Dennis is the butcher.
Yes, and Dennis Doyle, the butcher.
Dennis Doyle,
I was laughing listening to the piece on the portal, because that was where the butcher shop was situated on Northern I really enjoyed writing the detective. I mean, I think there's a lot of research done on the Dublin Metropolitan Police, and we tend to focus on their, I suppose, more of their involvement in... suppression of nationalist movements and things like
that.
Maybe
that's in the background here.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
But it seems to be the place they all want to work, the detectives.
Yeah, I think it seems glorified. Whereas most of what they're doing is patrolling the streets looking for sanitary, nuisances, bad smells, broken
and
sewers.
Endlessly
that
walking.
Around. Endlessly walking. Endlessly walking. Yeah.
He's a kind of a... I found it intriguing that he couldn't, as a detective, go into pubs.
Yes, yeah, there are a lot of rules. Yeah, a lot of rules about your behaviour. Now, I think a lot of them were disregarded, but if you got caught, then it would be, if you had ambitions for being promoted, as he does, then you probably tried to play by the rules.
He's hiding the fact that his engagement has collapsed.
Yes.
Because if he reveals, he has to move back into the barracks.
That's right, because if you were single, you were to live in the barracks. And so he's been given permission to move out of the barracks.
That was to keep them out of trouble, sort of thing, wasn't
it? And I guess to keep them fed as well, because they're on a very poor salary. Yeah, they don't get paid very well, so food is a problem.
Oh, and the food is revolting.
Yeah, and the food is revolting.
What an image of the city. But you clearly love Dublin.
I do.
And is it the fact that so much of what you're talking about is still there and you can actually walk around the city and point out?
Absolutely. And while I was writing the book, I did walk around different places. I wanted to cite things. And
remind me in the city where the brothels are.
They are in and around the famous Montgomery Monta. Street. Yeah, and they're sort of north inner city, the ones that I'm referring to in this
East
text,
of O'Connell Street, is that the, that's the Monta, isn't
basically,
it?
Basically, yeah.
Department of Education, Marlborough Street, all along there.
Exactly, yeah. It's been improved, I suppose, since
that's
then.
That's why I think a lot of visitors love Dublin, that it's quite low rise and you can see there are skylines that look exactly as they would have been 150 years ago and so on. That's fascinating. But you love Dublin, so the Brazen Head gets a mention as well.
It does,
old pub.
Yeah.
One still claims to be the oldest pub in Ireland, like only 75 others do.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I tried to bring in a few recognisable locations. Of course, names of streets have changed well. Things that got named particularly after nationalist figures were named other things in the middle of the 19th century. But I think people will recognize some of the places and the views. And as you say, because the skyline has remained low, even when buildings have been replaced, some of the views are very similar to what you would have got in the 19th century. Yeah. Mm.
And the Liffey is like a character.
And the Liffey is, because, I mean, they're so concerned with the river in the 19th century because all the waste is just being dumped into it. It's not until the beginning of the 20th century that they have kind of intercepting sewers to remove all that waste. So it's just full of everything going through down drains, through sewers, all the outflow of every tenement and slum and business and
add a heat wave to the
and
plot.
People, exactly. And then people just coming to the river and dumping things that they don't want.
Some people are probably listening going, that didn't really change for quite a long time.
Maybe,
it's quite clean now. I think there was a sort of a mid-noughties effort to clean it up, and you go up by Chapel, is it? It looks gorgeous, yeah, up along there.
I probably wouldn't swim in it. I don't.
Would you know that people swim in it? They once, do. You know, yeah. They have to have a very, very scrubbed shower afterwards,
yeah.
Deloused and all of that. You've become very Irish then, haven't you? You're involved in Gaelic football up in Dublin, just to continue.
Yeah,
Your love of Dublin stretches way beyond it.
Yeah, I got talked into going up to play Mothers and Others with Ballymun Kickhams some years ago. I arrived, they were playing a match. Someone put me on the pitch. I had no idea what was going on. It's sort of like basketball, but not really.
And that was your first concept you saw.
And I had watched a lot of it at that stage. Right. So I had sort of had the idea of what I was supposed to be doing, sort of. And then that person disappeared and never came back to the team. And I've been there for 8 years.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So how often do you get involved now?
It's about once a week.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
A good run around.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it's really for the company, I think, as much as anything. Yeah. It took me quite a long time to be able to kick a ball over the bar with any accuracy. But I'm very pleased when that happens now. But no, it's really good company. And so I've known some of those women for a long time. So we're always looking for new players. Anyone in the Dublin 9-11 area?
I'm surprised here because it's one of the busiest GAA clubs in the country.
Yeah. I think it's hard to keep, you know, by the nature of it, you're looking for women sort of over 25. They're having children and their jobs are taking off. So it's hard to keep people. We have a good core of 10 or 15, but always looking for more.
Named after Charles J. Kickham, I think, who's another 19th century. I'm sure you've gone through. He was Belfast revolutionary.
Yeah,
wasn't
I don't
he?
Know a huge amount about him, but they're each GAA club seems to have its nationalist hero as the.
That's true.
Most of
or them. A saint.
Yeah, or a saint. Yeah.
The same saint, just over and over again, all across the country. Yeah. And your kids, one of them has an Irish name at least, don't they?
Yes, they're both. They have, Aidan and Cian, they both have Irish
Cian,
names.
Cian, yes. So it's very much a Tenney's name, is that one?
Yeah, I think what you're looking for, especially maybe with boys' names, is things that don't rhyme with too many things, maybe.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think there
was. Okay, that's an interesting criteria.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, I don't know how we decided.
Rhyme with anything offensive.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Okay.
And maybe that the American relatives will be able to pronounce, so.
Well, I mean, you have Keane with a C. I mean, they're already lost.
No, they do okay. Once they've been told, yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
But your kids are Irish, obviously.
They were born here. They have American citizenship. So.
Aware of the fact that they're... Oh, they have American citizenship.
Yes. Because I'm an American citizen, they are entitled to that, and they must use their American passport to travel to the US. So,
interesting.
They can just walk straight in.
Well,
yes, and so the state can keep track of US. And
pay tax forever,
no
matter where you are.
Probably.
Do they know the lovely story about their parents meeting over typhoid?
Yeah, they do. I think they're maybe not so interested as children. Probably not.
But I gather that when they were babies, isn't that when you were doing all your masters? You managed to write and study?
Yeah, so I had just submitted my PhD when my eldest son was born. I remember saying to my mother, the only piece of parenting advice my mother gave me was to do with, I was very heavily pregnant as I was writing up my PhD, and I said, maybe I'll just finish it while the baby sleeps after he's born. And my mom was like, do not do that. You'll never finish it. You've got to finish it now. So,
sort of up all night trying to tap out a novel. Wouldn't really work. You also you've developed a friend over online, a writing friend who you've never met in person.
That's right. Jane, she is also writing a novel, a second novel. She's got one out on submission at the moment with her agent. We met through an online writing course called The Novelry, and we had a little chat forum. And then since then, we've been writing over Zoom, sometimes at 6 a.m, sometimes at lunchtime, just silent company, basically, to keep us going. Yeah. And I've never met her in person. She was hoping to come over for the book launch, but unfortunately.
Oh, where is she? She's
Based in London.
Oh, based in London.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So maybe over the summer I'll be in London.
Bridge the gap. You will know yourselves meeting in
person. I know. She'll probably be taller than I expect. That seems to be my usual thing. You meet someone on Zoom and you think they're the same height as you because you're eye level.
Down.
And then it turns out they're taller than you because most people are taller than me. So.
You hadn't had this discussion.
we haven't. No, I haven't asked her for her height specifics. No.
You have an interesting project going to do next. Sheridan Le Fanu, the...
Yeah. So, I don't know, have you read any of his?
Yes, In the Glass Darkly, which is the short story collection.
Exactly, yeah. So there's
not the most accessible, is it?
I don't...
In a way.
Yeah, maybe. I think, I mean, they are quite old-fashioned.
Very old-fashioned.
Yeah, and I like the... I don't know how you felt about the narrator. There's a sort of Dr. Hesselius character who's sort of presenting all his case studies of these sort of fantastical, ghostly, weird things that have happened. The stories individually, I think, are fun and kind of creepy. And the one that's probably most famous, maybe, is Carmilla, which
is a
vampire story. So I am rewriting that set.
That's a great idea.
Set in the 21st century.
So. Oh, you want to set it? Okay.
Yeah, so it's in Dublin. I've moved the location. At what stage is a rewriting, or I've just stolen the names of the characters? But anyway, I'm really enjoying that. So I have 19th century people in a 21st century city.
Curious. Yeah. So is it almost like a sequel?
No, it's
the original story is this woman is being tormented by a female vampire.
That's right, yeah.
And obviously there was lots of titters at the time. In the era, 19th century, going, what is going on here? We can't tolerate this, carry on. But it does popularise the whole vampire genre, doesn't it?
Yes,
it leads to
absolutely.
Bram Stoker writing his book and the whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very popular genre in the 19th century. It appears in theatre all the time, the sort of different versions of this vampire story. Not the Carmilla one, but different versions of a vampire story, I suppose. But yeah, I suppose for us, the Bram Stoker is really the kind of... entry of that into the popular consciousness. So I guess I'm it's still female vampire haunting females, but yeah, you'll have to wait and see.
But in the meantime, The Grateful Water is the place to go. Juliana Adelman is the author. Twisty, thrilling and visceral, does for Dublin what Dickens did for London. I think we covered that in our chat. Your kind of adoration for Dublin, and hopefully people will look at it in a different light and give poor old Dublin a chance.
Yeah,
given what the portal has done in recent times.
Exactly.
You know, it's always a test on our belief in the decency of our citizens. It just takes a tiny few.
Yeah.
And the tiny few are present in this novel as well. But there we go. Juliana, it's been a pleasure. Good luck now with The Mothers and Others in Ballymun and everything else you do. The Grateful Water is out now. Who's the publisher again? New Ireland.
Yes.
You're in very good company. 51551 is their text. Back after these.
Email oliver@rte.ie.